This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Mallory Avedon grew up in an ashram. Certainly not typical, but now this New York City playwright has put her experiences into a play that opens tomorrow night at Carolina Actors Studio Theater in Noda. She joins us to talk about her unconventional childhood and her unconventional play later in the program. First, just like everyone else, we want to get a jump on the holiday shopping season, and we want to find bargains sooner rather than later, and we want to know whether we have to get in the car and go shopping or whether we can get it done online, and if so, where, and if the holiday discounts have already started, and they have, why are we still talking and not finding out where to go now to get the best deals? Long sentence, good questions, and now on with the show. To talk about all of that and new shopping trends and the ongoing nature of holiday creep, we welcome Eli Portillo, not a holiday creep, but in fact a business reporter for the Charlotte Observer who has covered Black Friday for years. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
You're very welcome. And with us by phone, Candace Carlett, retail analyst and president of the consulting firm WSL, great radio station, by the way, WSL Strategic Retail, a firm well known for its How America Shops trend research, which predicts changes in shopping life. She joins us by phone from New York. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
What kind of holiday shopping season are we anticipating? What kind of season are retailers predicting? And I don't know who to ask this question of. I'll start with you, Candace, and then we'll go to the local level with Eli.
Sure. Well, you know, Mike, the season, from the retailer point of view, it's a scary season. This is their biggest season of the year, and the predictions are not so strong. But from the shopper's point of view, this is a very exciting season because the season is already well underway and there are lots of bargains.
Same true here?
Yes, and a lot of our local retailers are also getting in on the earlier openings, all the national trends that you're seeing. For example, Belk is opening on Thanksgiving Day itself at 8 p.m., Charlotte-based retailer, the first time they've done that.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit later on because there are some stores, major stores, and they're in South Park and other malls where Belk exists here locally that are not opening, and we'll talk about that in a second. Prior to the recession, and by the way, getting back to the holiday forecast, Morgan Stanley forecast the weakest holiday sales and the most promotional season since 2008. That's right at the start of the recession. So why would sales be so weak? And if sales are weak, I guess that's why the promotions are going to be great. But why aren't people back in the stores?
Well, I think part of that is all the uncertainty we've had this year. We've had things like the government shutdown. Mm-hmm. We've had things like the debt ceiling fight. And also the payroll tax has taken another 2% out of people's incomes.
How much of it has to do, and I'm not sure who to ask this of either, I guess Candace, I'll ask you, how much of this has to do that with the fact that prior to the recession, really, shopping and spending had pretty much gotten out of hand because money was flowing in the streets. All you had to do was reach down and pick it up out of the gutter, it seemed, and people could go and buy almost anything they wanted and did. And then the recession hit, and as people stepped back and took a look at what probably could be described as egregious overconsumption. And they still are thinking, I'm not going to go back to that, even if I could. I'm not going to go back to that. How much of this downturn in holiday shopping might be due to that?
You know, Mike, that is exactly where I was going. And I share your point of view about pre-recession being almost an aberration. All you had to do was get another home equity loan and you could buy what you wanted to do. Now we're looking at a shopper that's in a very different culture, and that's why this is so scary for retailers. It's not a moment in time that can be attributed to a headline. It's a new culture that says, enough with the stuff. Hmm. I love stuff, but I've got enough stuff. And credit is scary.
Interesting, which puts we are a consumer economy, and of course, as you said, Candace, earlier in the program, the Christmas shopping season is the do-or-die, make-or-break season for most retailers, which is why they call Black Friday Black Friday, because it is the day, supposedly, when most retailers flip from the red to the black. And we had Black Friday first as a shopping enticement. You pointed out, Eli, in one of your columns that it was only 3 years ago that Black Friday started on Friday, and now it starts much earlier than Friday. Stores began opening in the middle of the night on Thursday, so shoppers could get a head start, usually some of the best bargains. Now, as you pointed out, retailers are going to open up on Thanksgiving afternoon, Thanksgiving evening. What's going on here? Why can't we wait?
Well, I think a lot of it is what consumers want. If you look at the National Retail Federation surveys, I believe a quarter of the people who said that they're doing shopping this Black Friday weekend said that they plan to start on Thursday. And that's, I think, about 33 million people. And with a short shopping season this year, since Thanksgiving is so late, it's the shortest number of days that can be in the traditional holiday season. Mm-hmm. Retailers aren't going to pass that up. And retailers that do, like JCPenney last year with the 6 a.m. opening when many of its rivals opened hours and hours earlier, risk facing very weak sales.
Kansas?
And, you know, this goes back to also this new culture of, I set a budget, I have a limited amount to spend, and the retailer who's open first gets my money first. And, you know, we really have to realize, too, that Black Friday started back in November 1st. Walmart was promoting electronics in pre-Black Friday sales as early as November 1st.
But do people take advantage of those early sales, or are they waiting to see if there'll be deeper discounts later in the season?
We'll jump in. What we do know is that when you open and when you run a sale, people come. So the earlier, the better for retailers.
You mentioned, Eli, that Belk is opening up on Thanksgiving night for the first time ever. What other local stores, local malls are doing something similar to that?
Well, a lot of the big malls are doing similar openings. I believe South Park and Concord Mills are both doing 8 p.m. I haven't seen the hours yet for Carolina Place.
What about Northlake?
Northlake I haven't seen yet either, but I'd be shocked if any
of them. But if Belk is opened in South Park,
right,
it would be open in all of those.
Yeah, and I'd be shocked if any of them, you know, stuck with a later opening time.
Well, it's interesting. In the USA Today this morning, they're talking about some of the stores that are not opening on Thanksgiving. Nordstrom, Dillard's, two of the big stores in South Park, Home Depot, Costco, BJ's, TJ Maxx, Marshall's, Ross, not opening on Thanksgiving. You just said, Candidates, that if you don't open, somebody else is going to get your business. So why aren't they opening?
You know, they're not this year, but they probably will next year. I mean, this is a push and shove within companies. The culture of Thanksgiving Day being a special day versus staffing the stores on Thanksgiving Day with employees who want to be home with their families, there's a lot of things to consider. And some retailers say, you know, the top line maybe isn't most important.
If Belk opens at South Park, and South Park is one of the major malls here, Candace, because
you know Belk, yes, that's a mall.
But there are lots of small malls, strip malls, and even just small, you know, like Arboretum, for instance. If South Park opens, if Belk opens, do they feel compelled to open? Will they, in fact, be open, some of these smaller retailers in these mom-and-pop stores, in these mom-and-pop malls?
I haven't heard of any of the really small retailers, locally owned single-store mom-and-pop retailers opening on Thanksgiving. I think that the earlier openings of the major stores put more pressure on everyone to get that holiday shopping earlier, but you haven't seen it creep into that place yet.
And South Park and Belk, they'll open on Thanksgiving night at 8, they're planning to stay open all night long.
Yes.
Yeah.
What's wrong with us?
We were born to shop, Mike.
Do people really? I know you've done this for a column, but do people really get up and go to go shopping at 3:30 in the morning?
Yes.
And that's yes here in New York City too. They do. I have two of them in my house.
I've been covering Black Friday here in Charlotte. This will be my fourth year, and what really strikes me is the change that you've seen. I remember the first year I did it, I went to bed after Thanksgiving dinner. Mm-hmm. I woke up at around 3 in the morning and went out and started covering it. Next year I had to be ready at midnight, then I had to be ready at 8 last year. But every time, there have been lots of people in line. I've never seen an opening that hasn't been well attended, no matter how early they push it.
I don't care how wonderful the sales are and how much money the malls or the stores will make if they stay open all night long on Thanksgiving night. It's a terrible inconvenience for the stores themselves and for the people, the retailers who have to be there all night long. Does the money they make, Candace, make up for all of that?
Clearly, it must. And, you know, Eli, you raised a good point about the culture part, too. I'm not sure the best sales are on Black Friday anymore.
Wow.
But it's the excitement of being there, of doing it, of showing up. There's a passion around it.
There is, and it's a very quirky day in a lot of ways. You know,
quirky's a good word.
Last year, I remember I saw a woman in a leopard print onesie fighting or kind of jockeying for position with a guy in a full camo hunting gear for a cheap TV in Walmart, and you're not going to see that anywhere else. And I think a lot of people go for the spectacle.
She's very lucky he didn't have his shotgun.
I was going to say, right, she's a target.
An animal. So part of this is the thrill of the chase, the adrenaline rush that you get when you're in amongst shoppers who are bustling and jostling and trying to find the great bargain. That there's a rush to that.
Yes.
Where did I miss that day in class? What gene am I missing?
Well, you just don't have it, and that's okay. You know, we get the jeans we get, but there are people, they have a whole process. They pack their lunch, they bring a change of shoes. It's all planned, and they do it every year, and they love it. It's the kickoff for the holiday for them.
So now, Black Friday is partially in response, I understand, to Cyber Monday, which came along when online shopping began to take off, and now online shopping has eclipsed retail shopping, which we'll talk about because you've done some studies on this, Candace.
Yes.
But when is Cyber Monday still valid, or have the online discounts already begun?
The online discounts are well underway. I'm not sure Cyber Monday has been as important a day in shopping on the internet. I think the more important day is that day later in December when the online sites say, look, you only have two more days to get this with free shipping, or three more days. So it comes closer to Christmas Day, the surge to online shopping. But there's no question that retailers are using their websites, much earlier than Cyber Monday to draw the traffic.
So are things like Black Friday and Cyber Monday really antiquities? Are they dead? Do we need them
anymore? They're fading.
They're what?
They're fading.
They're fading.
There's no question that, you know, there's Black Friday, there's the Black Thursday night before, there's the 2 weeks before, and as we said, for some retailers, it's the first week in November that it starts.
And I think Black Friday got a black eye in 2008 that it's not totally recovered from, when a Walmart worker in Long Island was trampled to death by a surging crowd. And, you know, that's kind of taken some of the, you know, frantic line everyone up at the door, bust down the doors and get all the bargains. That's kind of taken some of that out of it, because now stores are much more conscious of crowd control, handing out tickets to people so they're not fighting to get first in line, letting people into the stores like Walmart does, and then starting the deals once they're already in the door. So some of that, I think, has really changed since 2008.
Is there a danger, and I only have a minute left here, but is there a danger in retailers opening too soon on Thanksgiving, or even opening on Thanksgiving at all? Could there be a backlash?
Well, I think this year will be probably the biggest test of that to date.
Mm-hmm. Candace?
And there doesn't seem to be. More retailers are joining in. I'm sure Belk's and Penny's are sitting there saying, geez, we should have done this last year.
Wow. When we come back, I want to talk about this whole concept, because it seems to me that if you sell something today, you're not going to sell it tomorrow. And if you sell a whole bunch of stuff today, you're going to sell a whole lot less tomorrow. Cannibalization. We'll come back and talk about that and other aspects of Black Friday and Cyber Monday and this whole idea, shopping frenzy idea, when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and PNC Wealth Management, with over 160 years of experience and a team of financial professionals committed to helping clients achieve their financial goals. More from Jennifer Green at 704-686-2129. And Lenore Ryan University graduate programs offering master's degrees in a variety of disciplines from the Hickory, Asheville, and Columbia, South Carolina campuses. Details at lr.edu/graduate. Well, first-time motherhood brings lots of joys. It also brings many challenges, as new moms face learning to budget for the baby's needs while handling the emotional and psychological changes that come with childbearing and child-rearing. Well, those challenges, if left unaddressed, can lead to some troubling things, including child abuse and neglect. But there is help out there for those that need it, and we will find out more tomorrow at 9.
on the next Diane Rehm Show. On the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination, a discussion of the public perceptions and political realities in the Kennedy White House, the city of Dallas, and the nation.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about holiday shopping and the beginning of the holiday shopping season, which officially begins now on Thanksgiving Day, not the day after, with Eli Portillo, who's a business reporter covering all this for years now with the Charlotte Observer, and Candace Corlett, who is a retail analyst and president of WSL Strategic Retail. I want to talk about the danger of opening so early and having all these bargains so early in the season. And some of this is echoed by David, who has contacted us on Facebook to say, I think it's sad that some people have to work on Thanksgiving this year. I am boycotting Thanksgiving sales and Black Friday, and I am doing my buying online or on another day. But if you do open on Thanksgiving or you sell a whole lot of stuff the day after Thanksgiving, what are you really accomplishing? Because there's only so much money a person has in their budget for all of this. If they spend it all at 8:30 on Thanksgiving night, they're not coming back on December 15th or December 19th, are they? Aren't you just cannibalizing sales, Candace?
Well, you know, Mike, that is what Belk is counting on opening Thanksgiving night, that they will get that money that folks have to spend on gifts. They will get it first because they're there. They're available, and that shoppers will come in and spend the money at Belk's, and you're right. Then there won't be much left to spend at Macy's or Penny's or Kohl's.
And in a environment like this where there's not a lot of growth in overall spending, you know, most of the predictions are pretty modest, between 2 and 4%. Every dollar that someone spends with you is likely to be a dollar they're not going to spend with a competitor. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if you open on Thanksgiving, a lot of people have a tradition of after dinner, if they're not watching football, going to the movies. So you're also stealing ticket sales, are you not?
I'm sure that doesn't add too much into the retailer's calculations. They're just glad that they're getting the sales. But you're absolutely right, Mike. It affects other parts of the economy. But we do know that when you open, shoppers come. And there will be some who will say, that's not fair to the employees. And that's what retailers sit and think about when they do these moves, when they make these moves.
Yeah.
Well, how do they balance employee feeling?
Let's talk about this. You wrote about this in The Observer about employees. I know that some Walmart employees have threatened to boycott or protest or whatever. What are local retail employees saying?
Well, there's actually a conference call today that is going to be about what the Walmart workers are doing. I will say that thus far we haven't seen a lot of major protests. Most of the protests last year were very small, a half dozen or so people, and you really haven't seen any kind of concerted walkouts, strikes, any kind of that backlash. And there are a lot of people out there who in these times are grateful for extra shifts. There are some people out there who need the money and are getting paid extra to work.
Well, what about them? Those who need the money need the bargains, and they can't go shopping because they're working. So,
well, but then they also have employee discounts. There's a lot of advantages. Eli's exactly right. This is a tough market to get jobs, and when you get extra shifts, and you know, Walmart has, you know, they're going to be serving turkey dinners to their employees. Does that compensate for being with your family? No, not really, but it's a gesture, and they are going to be paying people extra for working overnight. So they're at least acknowledging that this is a stress on employees, but we are in a labor market where people are very happy to get the extra hours.
All right, let's talk about the bargains for a second, because that's what people really want to know about. Are there really bargains to be had on Black Friday or on Thanksgiving night at 8 o'clock or on Cyber Monday, or do you have to be careful about what it is you're buying and the price you're paying? Could it be a come-on to get you into the store, Eli?
Well, you've seen this year a lot of real basement prices. You know, I think Walmart dropped their 32-inch TV from $148 to $98.
Excuse me, I got to go.
However, the catch
Just
with those is
online and get one.
Yep. there's always very few of those in the stores on Black Friday or Black Thanksgiving now, as it may be.
So in other words, if you're not one of the first 10 people there, you're liable not to get that deal.
Right. And with those kind of deals, that's when you see the camping out, the spectacle of people with tents in front of Best Buy. And with a lot of those, if you're not doing that, you're probably not going to get the $90 TV.
And I know that you wrote, Eli, about early bird Black Friday gifts being made available to the first X number of people at certain stores and at certain malls. If you go up to the customer service area in I think South Park, I think is one of the malls, if you're one of the first X number of people, you'll get a gift. What sorts of gifts are they giving?
You know, I actually don't have all the specifics on that. I believe South Park was a, quote, VIP bag, but I'm not positive what will be in your VIP bag.
So, Candace, what tips do you have for shoppers who are going to go shopping on Thanksgiving night or get up in the middle of the night to go shopping at a store to find the best bargains? What do you have any tips for those people?
Oh, absolutely. In addition to packing your lunch, definitely have a list. Know the targeted things that you're going for so that when those are on sale, you can be sure to get them. Understand the store policies. Some of the stores are going to be giving out bands, so if you waited online at 6 in the morning and they ran out, they will get you one at the sale price before the holidays. So do your homework before you get out there. Know exactly which stores have the items on sale that you need for your Christmas list. And be sure to target those stores and stop. Don't take time to browse. Just go for the bargain you're looking
for. Well, when you say do your homework, where do you do that?
Certainly online. All of
the Black Friday sales. Just buy it online?
There are people who just like to feel it and touch it. And when you get into some of the larger items, the shipping costs and offset the savings.
Well, let's talk about all of that, too, because I know that you reported, Candace, your organization reported troubling news for bricks and mortar retailers this month. You reported that shoppers feel that they get a better retail experience online than they do in stores. Why?
The top of the list is more information is available. And it depends on what you're buying. If you're looking for electronics or appliances, the ability to read about it, to read the reviews, to make a smart buying decision, there's much more information available online, and there's the opportunity to compare prices.
And since online shopping is now 60% of retail in the holiday season, it seems that more and more people are deciding to do that. Do you get the same rush when you're not just – because I know that one of the criticisms that people had in your survey, Candace, was there was not enough customer service. They couldn't find a sales associate. And if they did, they were usually too pushy. And they didn't like the chaos that they found in retail stores. They liked being able to sit in their jammies behind their computer and just buy what they want. So do they get the same rush that you're talking about, sitting behind their computer at 6 o'clock on a Thanksgiving night?
Well, those shoppers that we're talking to, the online shoppers, their rush is, I got this and I didn't have to leave the house. That's their big excitement. But as we said earlier in your program, Mike, there's a culture of I want to be out there with the frenzy, I want to rub elbows with people, and I want to be part of the scene.
Wow.
Whenever I go to see the people who are the first in line waiting at Best Buy, whatever store they're camping in front of, they always have a friendly rapport. They have a sort of camp mentality where they're all in this together. They're having fun. They're making friends. It might look crazy to sleep outside when it's, 35 degrees out to get a cheap Xbox, but a lot of people really like that.
Right. It's a culture that you really can't explain with logic.
And you'll leave it at that.
Right.
Eli, you wrote in The Observer recently that we in Charlotte use smartphones more than the national average. That should make us glowingly proud. But tell me how smartphones have changed the retail shopping experience. Because I've got several apps where I scan barcodes all the time.
Well, that was from a Deloitte study where they broke out some local data about Charlotte. And I believe they attributed that to our lower median age here for our residents. For example, it's really changed how we shop for me in terms of using it to look up information while I'm in the store.
Yeah.
Best Buy has kind of taken advantage of this with their showrooming program where they're trying to embrace this. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a quick example. The last time I went and had to buy some computer accessories, I needed to look up which one was the best. And the sales guy, of course, told me the most expensive one was the best in Best Buy. I used my phone. I found some great ones for much less that had five-star reviews, and that was how I made my decision. So for a lot of people, it's really come to almost displace the salesperson.
On the one hand, Candace, because yeah. I've done this many times, scan a barcode and you'll find out that you can get that item that's selling for $99.99 where you are for maybe $89.99 or $63 on Amazon or something like that. On the other hand, sometimes it is always, no matter where you look, it is always $99.99. I thought there were antitrust laws against price fixing.
Well, there's certainly laws, and I'm not a lawyer, but there are laws against companies talking among each other and comparing prices and setting
prices.
But
they don't have to talk. All they have to do is go online and look.
It's very visible, and you don't even have to send someone around for a day walking stores. It's very visible online.
So just as we are getting smarter and learning how to use the Internet and our smartphones to find bargains, the retailers are getting smarter, and they are not going to undercut each other. They're going to just take it as it is.
And they're able to change prices from a central location in all the stores on a minute, moment's notice.
So you talked a second ago about the shopping experience online versus bricks and mortar. And there are price differences sometimes. And sometimes when it's cheaper online. And sometimes when you shop online, for some reason, the shipping is free. So if you find something cheaper online and you're standing in the store, should you expect that the bricks and mortar retailer will meet that price?
You can always ask. Can't hurt to ask. And you can show it to them. I know you can do that in Best Buy. You can show them the lower price, whether or not they match it. I don't know what the policy is. It's probably very different by product category, but it doesn't hurt to ask.
Should you ask them to meet the price minus shipping, or should you include the shipping cost? If you have to pay shipping and you're paying $15 over the price and that actually puts it just a couple of bucks below the retail store price, should you ask for that price or should you ask for the item price?
You should ask for everything.
And you're a retailer's friend?
Sure, I'm a retailer. Actually, our business is how America shops, studying how shoppers shop.
Okay.
And we have the advantage of learning all these smart tricks from all the shoppers we talk to all year long.
What do you hear? Do retailers here match online prices? Do you know?
I don't know too much about the local mom-and-pop retailers. Many of them, you know, aren't able to because they don't have the efficiencies of large retailers who can take advantage of things like national supply chains.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, like Candace said, it never hurts to ask.
Patrick on Facebook writes, when I worked at a major discount retailer who will go unnamed on this program, even though he put it in the email, most of the doorbuster stuff was returned because it was just cheap junk that broke in a few weeks. Is that the rule of thumb?
Well, sometimes, you know, you'll see things like, say, a TV that is really cheap where it will only have, say, one input for a video device like a DVD player or a cable box, not two or three or four like a normally priced TV. So a lot of the stuff is custom made to be a doorbuster.
Ah, who knew? So you really do, particularly when you're buying electronics and computers and things like that, you really need to know the specs that you think you need and the ones that you want and make sure the item that's on sale has that. Otherwise, you've paid not much money, but you've put out money for something that you're not going to like, ultimately.
And that's where you see the long lines outside somewhere like Best Buy where the merchandise they advertise is national name brands.
Mm-hmm. Mason emails, I'm grateful to hear you bringing up employer ethics because this has all become an artificial bump created by management that makes highly questionable decisions minute to minute all year long and then obviously tries to correct the results of their own greedy incompetence during one accelerated rat race sprint. These managers don't seem to be the cream of the leadership crop, and they are definitely subject to very juvenile peer pressures rather than simply taking a stand and earning back the dedication and respect of their hardworking employees. Well, now, what's your thoughts on that, Candace?
You know, we are in a wonderful capitalist society where the success of a company is ruled pretty much by its shares value on the stock market, and the responsibility of business is certainly, in addition to pleasing its shoppers and taking good care of its employees, to make sure that the value of the company is protected. Because if the value goes down, then they can't hire employees. They have to cut back.
You say that 60% of consumers now shop online, and that makes this holiday shopping season a fitness test for retailers.
Yes.
How so?
You have to be out there very early. Did you ask for shoppers or for retailers, Mike?
You say it's a fitness test for retailers.
Oh, yes, definitely for retailers, because they have to be so agile. They have to make hard decisions like this, bringing employees in on Thanksgiving night. They have to make hard decisions about, if I sell a lot of this at this price now, I will pay the piper in February when the financial reports come out and my bottom line is weak. They have to make a lot of hard decisions about what merchandise to stock so they don't run into inventory problems. So it's definitely a fitness test of their ability to run a store at a profit.
And it seems to me also, Eli, that stores have got to be able to compete with online retailers almost up to the minute. Otherwise, they become a showroom for something. You go, you touch, you feel, you play with, and then you go home and you order it online.
Yeah, that's sort of been an ongoing concern for retailers now for a long time, people using their stores as a showroom and then ordering off, say, Amazon.
Yeah.
A lot of stores, I think Best Buy is probably the best example, are trying to take advantage of this and encouraging people, yeah, use us as a showroom. Just buy from us online when you go. We'll give you a good price.
Should we feel bad about that? Should we feel bad that we go to a retailer, a bricks-and-mortar retailer, to look at the product, talk to their salespeople, actually touch and feel what we've looked at online, and then because we can get it for $10 cheaper online, we go home and buy it that way? Should we feel guilty about that?
Do you?
Sometimes, yes.
Well,
never.
Never? That's because you're a New Yorker. You're a
job.
Hard-bitten New Yorker. That's why.
It's a retailer's job to make sure, and that's part of the fitness test, make sure you're doing things to please me. And the retailer's opportunity is to say, okay, what can I add to your experience so you will pay $10 more? How do I make it more valuable to you?
Do retailers care? Does Macy's care, for instance,
yes,
whether you buy from them online or whether you buy from them in their stores? Would they not prefer that you buy from them online? Because that way they can close some of these great big stores and save a ton of money.
Well, you're a visionary, Mike, and that's certainly where retail is gradually going, to smaller stores, to less inventory in the stores. But at the moment, a store like Macy's, its job is to please both shoppers, all shoppers, because as Eli said earlier in the show, there's so little money being spent that you have to please the online shopper and the in-store shopper so you get as much of that cash as you can.
And for example, Lowe's, based around here, they have recently introduced more inventory in stores because they find that when people come, they still want to actually buy things in person. They're Black Friday sort of later in the year, but they've found they can't rely on online retailing.
Eli Portillo is a business reporter who follows all this in the pages of the Charlotte Observer, has written a number. I mean, I can't even count the number of articles that you've written about this. I'm sure you can.
I can't.
And Candace Corlett is retail analyst and president of WSL Strategic Retail. Thank you very much for the time. Happy shopping. Happy holidays to you.
It was very nice to be with both of you, too.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia. Subaru share the love event in November with a full line of all-wheel drive Subaru vehicles, including the new 2014 Forester and certified pre-owned vehicles. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And Northeastern University, with a hybrid graduate curriculum in online and in-class courses and experiential learning with 3,000 corporate partners. December 11th, info session, graduate.northeastern.edu. In a two-hour special on John Kennedy's presidency and the 50th anniversary of his assassination, Diane Rehm and a special panel of experts explored gaps between public perceptions and political realities driving the events of the era and on JFK's impact on American history. That all begins in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And in a moment, we meet a woman who grew up in an ashram, and she's only happy to tell you about that experience at Cast Theater Stage.
My car Dave was in the shop over 40 times in 8 months. Hi, I'm Paula Poundstone from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So one time, I slammed the door, and as I do so, the back of the front seat just fell off. I had never realized how important the back of the front seat is until the following day when I was driving up a hill and began to slide into the back seat. Turn your car into the programs you love.
Donate your car through Car Talk's vehicle donation program. Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Having an unconventional childhood can either be a curse or a blessing, and I suppose it depends on how that childhood impacts you as an adult. I don't know how Mallory Avedon regards her unconventional childhood, but perhaps watching the play she wrote, which is loosely based on her experience of growing up in an ashram, might give me some clues. Guru, 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 or Why I Don't Want to Go to Yoga Class with You opens tomorrow night at Carolina Actors Studio Theater, and we're joined now by the playwright, Mallory Avedon. Welcome, or should I say namaste?
Good morning.
Good morning. And also with us is the artistic director at Cast, Michael Simmons. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
This play had its premiere this year at the Humana Festival of New American Plays. The Cast production will be the nation's second production of this play, which is pretty remarkable. How did you find it, and why did you feel it was so important, so interesting, so Cast, that you wanted to rush it into production in the same year that it premiered?
Well, we're always in a competition for getting the best new works here, and Humana Festival is one of those sources. I think we've gone for the last 17 years. I think we've done more Humana Festival plays than any other theater in our region. I'm not sure if we don't have our picture on the security camera there, because when we find those plays, we try to rush the playwrights, and I remember the experience of meeting Mallory for the first time outside of the theater, begging her, please let us do this because this is going to be so cool.
Well, we've talked a lot about how theater companies here approach playwrights for plays early on, because you do that, Actors Theater does that. I've never talked to the playwright about what that feels like to be approached. What's it like, Mallory, to be approached by a person you don't know from a city you've never been to, who runs a theater that you know absolutely nothing about, who says, I want to do your play?
Flattering. Also a little bit nerve-wracking, but the fact that Cast has done, for example, Death Tax, that was at Humana the year before my play in the same theater, and Adam Rapp's Edge of Our Bodies, I know they have good taste.
It is said that you are a playwright interested in the intersection of fact and fiction, and I know I said that you grew up in an ashram, and part of this play is about that. Why is the intersection of fact and fiction interesting to you, and how much of this play is fact versus fiction?
I think that in this world that we live in right now, where everyone is so focused on memoir and reality television and all of this, I'm still interested in a world where the imagination has some place. So I never want to be like, oh, this is a documentary play that I wrote. There's still a lot of sort of magic in my work.
Hmm. Exactly. For those people who don't know, exactly what is an ashram?
Well, that's what the play is about. I've been having this crazy experience, actually, in the last year. I wrote the play as a way to be able to have that conversation with people, because in person it becomes really complicated. And now that I wrote the play, I end up having the conversation even more. it's a little frustrating or hilarious.
And I know, Michael, that you like to, you produce experiential theater. You like to turn the theater space itself into what the play is about, to immerse the audience in all of this. What do you know about ashrams, and what kind of research did you have to do? Because I'm sure the whole daggone theater is an ashram.
I knew absolutely nothing about an ashram before I saw this world premiere at Humana Festival. And we had to do our homework. We had to go online, research what the whole experience was, what it looked like. There was a great reference in the play about an article that was written in the New Yorker, so we had to pull that up. And all the girls actually that are in our play, we have 12 of them. Our focus is on women playwrights. plays that have leading women, and that's what we focused on this year. And we've got this wonderful cast who actually turned our theater into the Ashram after doing their homework and their research. Mm. Hmm. So it'll be a good experience for
your lead character in this play, Guru Guru Guru, is Lila. Is that how you say her name, Lila? She also grows up in an ashram, and the message here, as I understand it, is that attending yoga classes does not make you a guru or a yogi or even a person prepared for the future. So what does it prepare you for, Mallory?
Well, I don't think that anything in particular prepares you for anything else in particular. Every step of your life is a step that you have to take forward. I mean, I think that marketing language isn't something that I wrote.
You don't agree with it.
It's an interesting take.
Okay. Well, I don't know what it prepared you for, but it certainly produced the most creative theater work we've ever experienced.
Well, let's talk about that, because this is an interesting – it's a 90-minute without intermission production in three segments. I guess three acts, but three parts, certainly. And one part involves a PowerPoint presentation, not exactly my idea of riveting theater, but obviously I'm going to be proven wrong, a puppet show, and also a visit to the set of the film Eat, Love, Pray, with a special guest appearance by Julia Roberts. How are you making all this happen?
Well, it's an interesting way of staging it. We don't want to give away too many of the secrets.
Come on, it's just you and me.
And 1 million of your listeners. It's so wonderful the way it seamlessly evolves from one scene to the next, and there's not like an act one break and an act two break, and that's part of the charm of the play and the surprise of the plot points as we move forward in the drama / comedy. And then, of course, there's always the chance of audience participation. Not that I can confirm or deny any of those rumors.
Yeah. So when you write something like this, do you take into account that you're providing directors and actors with considerable hurdles to cross, Mallory?
Definitely. This piece started out as my thesis in grad school, and I honestly never thought that anyone would produce it outside of that setting because the hurdles are very, very great. It is. It does not look like how plays usually look, and I'm just really so thrilled about both Les Waters and the Humana Festival taking a chance on the play, and now cast doing it. It's really exciting.
Well, one woman's hurdle is another man's opportunity. Mm-hmm. That's really one of the things that attracted me to this play, was because it was different, and it has a different theatrical structure than most of the plays that you would normally see. The other opportunity, I think, that allowed us to produce this play is, and I know that this isn't a regular thing that the theater patron does, because plays are produced live and they're very visual and very audible, but I read the text. And when I read the text, even the way the text was laid out is very poetic and lyrical, and that inspired me to think on different levels as far as the production values. How it was actually written in stanzas, believe it or not, actually affects how we're going to light the show, and how as the theater experience evolves and rolls over, we incorporated that into the way the colors on the set change. So
you just used the word stanza, which to me is poetic.
So, it is poetic.
So, but when you say stanzas in this sense, mm-hmm. are these the three different parts? Are there three stanzas, or are there stanzas throughout this thing that cause it to progress from one moment to the next?
All of the above.
Well, there you go.
In deference to our actors and our stagehands, we are not open on Thanksgiving. I was married to a retail manager for 17 years and still am. But we are open the day after Thanksgiving and that weekend. So,
Mallory, your work has been produced by theaters all over the country, including Seattle Rep. And you open your latest play, Mary-Kate Olsen Is in Love, off-Broadway just 2 days ago. You're having a year of it. Is Guru a good example of your work, or is it very different from the work that's been produced? Because you just said that you never expected it ever to be produced.
I think structurally it's definitely the most challenging, but I have a certain obsession with pop culture and celebrity, and also with liveness and spirituality that I definitely think it's a good example of that.
Let's talk about that pop culture thing, because you include references in most of your plays, if not all of your plays, to pop culture. Mary-Kate Olsen, of course, the off-Broadway play running now, Julia Roberts in this one, and there are others as well. And you say that pop culture is our common language at this point.
I mean, we're inundated by media all of the time. So even if not everyone has the same exact references, that sort of currency of celebrity and these images that we're having in our lives, on our phones and on our computers and in the world all the time.
Well, my question, I guess, would be, that all makes for really relatable experiences right now today. But are you afraid that you are dating your material so that in a year, 5 years, 10 years, no one will ever do it again? I mean, you pick up Neil Simon's Barefoot in the Park, which was blisteringly funny in its time, and it's not that old, but it's old. And you look at it now, and even though it has the rhythm, you can predict where the laughs are going to come. The laughs aren't quite as strong as they were 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, because it's becoming a period piece. Are you worried about that?
No, I'm really not. I don't think that the canon, sort of in the way that it used to exist, continues to exist. And as a playwright of new plays, I would be much more excited in someone producing the play that I write in 10 years than feeling the need for everything I write to still be relevant. I would much rather be able to relate to this moment now in my work.
But you hope that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, and hope that people are still interested in what I'm doing that is different in 5 years or in 10 years.
But you live in the world, and playwrights, although they can nourish themselves by sitting behind a computer and writing all day and then watching their work being mounted on the stage, you still have to eat. And it seems to me that most of the money a playwright makes is going to be in royalties from the productions of their plays. So don't you want these plays to have a really long life? And don't you run the risk of not having them have a really long life, and therefore you having to have to constantly crank this stuff out to keep your food on the table?
If I was most concerned about money, I would be doing something else entirely.
You'd be directing.
Oh, yes. I'd be a sound designer. I know what you're saying, absolutely. And, of course, I want people to produce these plays, but I feel like thinking about whether or not they're relevant 10 years from now makes them not relevant now. So
I am
short-sighted, perhaps.
You've worked on this play now for a long time, because I know the cast rehearses for a very long time. So in your opinion, in 5 years, could you revisit this piece?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's more timeless than even Mallory thinks right now.
Okay. One of your goals, Mallory, which I really think is cool, and perhaps the major reason you like to use pop culture references, is that you want young people who like to go see bands play, come to the theater. You want young people to get past their opinion that theater is boring, which I'm not sure they have, because I see a lot of young people now at musicals of all things. But how do you make theater more like going to see a band?
I'm oriented toward it being an event, which is, I think, where I intersect with cast, this idea of immersion, and also just making a building that feels accessible to young people. Doing the show at the Flea right now really feels that way.
That's the off-Broadway theater. That's the off-Broadway theater.
Yeah, in New York. And it's a theater that young people are really attracted to. It's in Tribeca, and it has a resident non-equity company with young people. So I think it's both about the work and about choosing venues, and also just making work with characters that young people are interested in.
This sounds exactly up your alley.
Yes, that's exactly what we try to do, and that's the whole point of what CAST's mission is to create the experiential theater. How do you get people, and young people in particular, because we want to inculcate that new theater audience away from the bands, the bars, the, you know, the sitting home on the couch watching TV. I love your passage earlier on, Mallory, where our character Savita welcomes everyone and then asks you, you know, did you make a mistake coming? Wouldn't you rather be home watching TV? And it's okay. You're going to have a good experience. Trust me. And but again, that's the charm of this play. That's why we were so excited. That's why I rushed, almost bum rushed Mallory on the street, because we had literally gotten out of the play and we realized how germane this was to cast's mission and what opportunity it was for us to produce it.
I know that you watch a lot of television, but you also talk about theater not being in competition with television because it's an experience about being in an experience with other people where you're not on your phone. Well, there you go. You've lost all the young people.
I think that young people are so much more excited to actually be around people and not be on their phones than they think they are. It's just giving people an opportunity for that.
I also want to point out that when you write, you listen to a lot of music, and when you're rehearsing your plays, you listen to music. And the song "I and Love and You" by the Avett Brothers is, I think, one of the songs that you like the most at the moment. They're from around here, so why is that important to you? Why is that song attractive to you?
It's the most played song on my iTunes by like 200. I have listened to that song 200 more times than any other song on my iTunes. I think it's beautiful. I did not know that they were from around there. Yep. Maybe they'll come see my play.
They very well might. I have to stop because we're out of time. Mallory Avedon is the playwright of Oh Guru, 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 or Why I Don't Want to Go to Yoga Class with You at CAST, November 22nd, tomorrow night through December 14th. Michael Simmons, the artistic director, also with us. Thank you both for being
here. Thank you, and we'll see you tonight, Mallory.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.